Printed History of the King James Text, 1629, Cambridge Edition, Part 2. So if you recall last week, I had forgotten my tablet, which did impact my ability to show certain things as far as what we were talking about in the lesson. Fix that this week. So if you're joining us right now on Facebook, YouTube, or on the church's website and you wish to follow along, you can scroll down, go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down to recent sermons. You're going to want to click on May 19, lesson 235, and then you click on that link and you can open up to what we're going to be going through today. And it's going to be important to follow along with a lot of the illustrations. So, I'm going to say at the front of this, I'm going to take the time it takes on this, alright? There's some examples here. I've got screenshots, I've got photographs of what we're talking about here so that we can see with our own eyes what's going on and not have to take anybody's word for it, okay? So let's get into the introduction. In lesson 234, we began discussing the 1629 edition of the Authorized Version edited and published by Cambridge University Press. In doing so, we consider the following points. Number one, we looked at a brief history of Cambridge University printing rights. So we went back and saw how under Henry VIII in 1534, the Cambridge University Press was originally granted printing rights, and we'll talk a little bit about the history of the university press. And then second, we started talking about the 1629 Cambridge edition. Now, my decision to use David Norton's book, A Textual History of the King James Bible, to frame this discussion has come under scrutiny this past week on social media. Again, that is this book right here by David Norton, A Textual History of the King James Bible. Okay? And I am aware of the fact that as I speak right now, my published notes that are on the screen behind me have already been critiqued by the same individual. Okay, I'm not going to mention who they are. To me at this point, it's irrelevant. We're going to go through the information. It's always nice to have your notes critiqued before you've actually taught the material. Okay, but anyway, that seems to be the situation that exists today. It has been asserted that Professor Norton is unsaved. How, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I'm not aware of any profession of faith on the part of Professor Norton, so maybe it's true that he's not a saved person. Read the rest of the statement. Professor Norton is unsaved and therefore is not to be trusted in his reporting of textual data slash facts. So because he's not saved, he cannot catalog or collate information. That is the assumption. Alright? This assertion is coupled with the premise that Norton edited his own edition of the King James Bible for Cambridge University Press called the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible. That is true. I have a copy at home in my possession of the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible. I have never supported, let me say it as clear as I can, I have never supported or advocated for the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible. I don't use it. I have it as a piece of historical evidence and reference. I don't read from it. I don't preach from it. I don't use it. Do I own one? Yes, I do. Is it true that a textual history of the King James Bible was prepared as a companion volume to the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible? Yes. Okay, that is true. Let me see here. Just because Norton makes editorial decisions in his New Cambridge Paragraph Bible that I would not approve of does not mean that his presentation of the textual facts as it relates to the printed history of the King James Bible texts are in error. Okay? So if he catalogs something and he does it accurately, just because he's not saved potentially, and just because he made decisions in the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible that I wouldn't agree with or approve of, does not automatically mean that everything the guy said is false. Okay? And there are at least two parties on the internet that seem to be talking in those ways. Okay? One needs to distinguish between Norton's cataloging of textual variants in the printed history of the King James text and his editorial work on the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible. Let's just stop there. Does everybody understand what I'm getting at? Okay? And the other thing I want to add, I'm not only relying on Norton, I'm also relying on Dr. Lawrence Vance, the text of the King James Bible. This is still in manuscript form, and you can buy the manuscripts for every chapter, which I have done as I've tracked along with that. So, and those who would potentially have a problem with Dr. Norton certainly would not have the same problem with Dr. Vance, since Dr. Vance is a saved person, is a Acts 2 Baptist preacher, and is a King James Bible advocate. Okay, so he is advancing along similar lines as what Dr. Norton has. And if you don't believe me, you should also read Lawrence Vance's 2015 book, The Making of the King James Bible New Testament, which I have cited and brought in to class many times. So there's a false argument, guilt by association argument that is going on in social media. Okay. So regarding the scope of the work undertaken by the Cambridge University Press in producing the 1629 edition, Norton stated the following quote: "The editors made more changes to the text than any other set of editors." So we talked about this last week. This is a review point. By my count, counts of this sort always have an element of roughness. So again, does Norton admit that there's a certain element of roughness to the numbers? Okay. They introduced 221 readings, of which 199 became standard. In terms of frequency, this is roughly one new reading every five chapters. They also confirmed a further 59 variants from the first edition found in some earlier editions. The spelling of names is largely but not entirely a scholarly matter. They introduced 178 spellings, of which 157 have become standard, and they confirmed another 40. Overall, 493 changes were made, of which 447, 91%, became standard from the 1629 Cambridge edition. That's just counting readings, counting math, counting what is standard, okay? So thus far, we have noted two categories of changes that were undertaken by the 1629 edition. Number one, readings, standard and rejected. And number two, spelling changes, standard, rejected, and confirmed. That is what we talked about last week in Lesson 234, okay? So we want to continue now our look at the Cambridge 1629 Cambridge edition at the bottom of page 1, okay? In the next section of chapter 5, Norton deals with specific examples of the styles of changes made in the 1629 Cambridge edition. All right? So notice what he says, top page 2. Consideration of the textual changes may usefully begin with some exceptions. Only once did the 1629 editors allow themselves to rewrite. So that would mean rewrite a verse. Okay? Job 4:6 in the first edition has a reading that was created in Bod 1602. Quote, "Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, the uprightness of thy ways, and thy hope?" That is what they had. I will show you this in picture form here in a minute. Okay? This is glossing rather than translation of a difficult verse. It gives the Hebrew words just as they come without making sense. By omitting this and moving "and," the editors make sense. Is not thy fear, thy confidence, and the uprightness of thy ways, thy hope? To paraphrase, did you not trust in your piety and your moral perfection? The significance of this lies in its uniqueness. The 1629 editors rarely make the text less literal, and nowhere else do they presume to rewrite. Now, let's just say, is that Norton's opinion?
Yes.
And he's saying that they have rewritten the text. Now, before we go any further, I want to remind you of a couple things. Okay? The first thing that I want to remind you of is what we saw already from the pen of David Reagan. David Reagan said that the only changes that occur in the various editions of the King James Bible were typeface, correction of printer errors, and spelling and punctuation. You remember that? Okay? So, I'm working on something for a different purpose, but let's look at some definitions of print errors. Okay? Printer's error. An error introduced into typeset copy by the compositor. The compositor is the person who is setting the type on the page. They're picking the type out of the tray and they're putting it on the page for typesetting. Okay? And they are introduced in a typeset copy by the compositor so that the printer cannot charge for correcting it. So in other words, it's a mistake in the printer's house that the compositor put the wrong type or made a mistake. Does that make sense? Okay? That's from Collins English Dictionary. Printing error, a misprint or misspelling in a text. Okay? Printer's error, dictionary.com. An error introduced into typeset copy by the compositor so that the printer cannot charge for the correcting of it. In all of this, is that the same as the ones up there? Okay? Compositor. A person who sets the type, the text, or type for printing. Okay? So, by definition, what is a printer error? By definition, what is a printer's error? It is a mistake made by who? The compositor in the laying out and setting forth of the type. Okay? That is different from an author's alteration. A correction or change made in typeset copy that is not a correction of an error introduced by who? That means that someone else is saying that they want the text to read what? Differently. Does that make sense? Okay? Now, I also want to flip back into this piece, and I want to go to page 7 and remember this statement. Okay? This is reading from Reagan, The Myth of Early Revision, page 7. The character of the textual changes is that of obvious errors. The frequency of the textual changes is sparse, occurring only once per 3 chapters. The chronology of textual changes is early, with about 3/4 of them occurring within 27 years of the first printing. All these details establish the fact that there were no true revisions in the sense of updating the language or correcting translation errors. So what is he saying? There was no true what? Revision. In what way? Updating the language or correcting translation errors. There were only editions which corrected early typographical what? Errors. Or our source of authority for the exact wording of the 1611 authorized version is not in the existing copies of the first printing. Our source of authority for the exact wording of our English Bible is in the preserving power of Almighty God. What is he saying? He's saying it doesn't matter what's where in the first edition. First edition is their material. What's important is what God preserved. Just as God did not leave us the original autographs to fight and squabble over, so he did not see fit to leave us the proof copy of the translation. Our authority is in the hand of God, as always. You can praise the Lord for that. So he's saying, flat out, okay, all of these details establish the fact that there were no true revisions in the sense of updating the language or correcting translation errors. Does he not say that? So, according to what we've seen then, the only categories of difference should be typeface, spelling, punctuation, and clear what? Clear printer errors, and a printer error is defined as what? An error introduced to the typeset copy by the compositor so the printer cannot charge for correcting it. Okay? Is everybody with me so far? Any questions? Okay, let's jump back into the notes. And let's look at the example here. Okay, consider the following screenshots charting what Professor Norton is talking about. So we just read him talking about Job 4:6. Okay, so the first screenshot here is of the base text. So here is the 1602 bishops, which is the text that the translators were tasked with revising. We've been over this 100 times, right? And then notice what it says. And by the way, you should grab your Bible and credibly open to Job 4:6. Job Job 4, verse 6. So rule one, as we've talked about ad nauseum, said that they were to follow the text of the bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original said otherwise. Right? Okay? So here's the base text where it starts. Okay? It says, is this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and thy upright living? That's where we start with, according to the first screenshot from a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Does everybody see that in front of you and on the screen? Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, Bod, or Bode, I've heard it pronounced both ways, 1602 records the revisions of the translators as they follow rule number one and change this or conform this into what would ultimately be the King James text. Okay? So let's note the changes. Okay? So I want to have these like this so we can see both at the same time. Right? So, they insert the word not. Was not in the 1602 bishops. No. So there's a caret here, and you can see they insert above the line what word? Not. So is not this thy fear, thy confidence, okay? Notice, what do they remove? They remove thy hope, okay? Thy uprightness of thy ways, and notice they move thy hope where? To the end, okay? So do they completely revise this last clause? Yes or yes? Okay? Does everybody see what's going on? Okay? So now we can compare the edits of Bod with what shows up in the 1611. Okay? So here's the 1611. Should probably go up a little further. Notice, is, now is in italics, not, so did they retain the insertion of the word not? Yes. Is not this thy fear? Is not this thy fear? Thy confidence? Thy confidence? Wait a minute.
That's right.
That's right. Thy uprightness of thy ways and thy what? So do they basically take the revisions that are in Bod and reproduce them in the 1611?
Yes.
So does everybody see how we start objectively with this as the base reading? Bod revises the base reading into this reading, and then does this reading become the 1611 reading?
Yep.
Does everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
Did I miss something there, Amy?
There was one V and I.
I think
I may have messed up too. This should say the uprightness. So we need to correct this. This should say the uprightness here. See?
Yeah,
that's my mistake. This should say the uprightness. So that's another change. So, here's the point. Okay? What's that?
They also changed the period at the end to a question mark.
Period here to a question mark here, right?
The bishops have a period at the end, and
right, so, well, I think that might be a question mark. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell. But you're definitely right, there's a question mark. So, here is the point. Besides my mistake. So we need to change that. Do you guys know the change in that?
Yes.
Okay. So, do they adopt, essentially, the revisions recorded in Bod?
Yes.
See how this gets tedious, right? You gotta check this stuff out, like, okay? So now let's look at the Cambridge text that we are talking about. We are talking about the 1629 Cambridge, okay? And let me see if I can get both of these on the screen at the same time. Now watch what happens now, okay? Problem is, okay. Is that still italics? Is not this thy fear? Now what? Is not thy fear? What's missing?
Yeah.
This. Have they taken this out?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Thy confidence? Thy confidence. We have insertion of what?
And.
and the uprightness, as opposed to, and that should say the uprightness, we already called that mistake, right? Of thy ways, uprightness of thy ways, and notice what's taken out here. And. So let me ask you a question. If we don't go any further, is it a true statement that there were never any wording changes between 1611 and 1769?
29 or 69?
Let's go 69. 1629, were there any wording changes?
Yes.
Yes. Are they obvious print errors? Are they obvious places where you could say that the compositor made a mistake?
Sometimes.
Maybe, maybe not, right? Okay? So let's look at the next statement. The Cambridge, the 1629 Cambridge omits this and moves the and from the end of the verse to the middle. Is that a printer error? Moving the word and, is that a printer error or an editorial change?
Editorial error.
That's an editorial change. Okay? The 1629 Cambridge omits this and it moves the and from the end of the verse to the middle. Professor Norton continues his explanation of this example from Job 4:6 as follows. The small license they took here, referring to the 1629 editors, led to further license. The second Cambridge edition, 1638, created the received reading by restoring this and changing the order of the last part of the sentence. Okay? So let's look at 1628. Okay? So notice, did they put the this back in? This time it's in italics. Right? So if you go back to the previous, so the 1629 here, did it take out the word this? Yes. Is 1638 putting the word this back in? Yes. Is not this thy fear? Okay? Thy confidence. Now, thy hope. Where was that before? At the end. So have they taken thy hope and moved it in the sentence? Is that a printer error or an editorial change? That is not a printer error. You will never convince me that that is not an editorial change. You'll never convince me that's a printer error. That is a later editor moving that clause. Sorry. So, I understand that does not fit the talking points that we just looked at. It doesn't fit the talking points, but you cannot get around the objective fact that that's a change. Now, it's not a substantive change. It doesn't impact what the verse is saying doctrinally, but is it an editorial change? Is an entire clause moved? Okay? So, thy hope and the uprightness of thy way. So, let's look at the table now, comparing them all side by side. All right? So, here we go. We can start with the 1602 bishops. All right? This is thy fear, thy confidence. I think that's my mistake as well. Should be thy hope. We need to fix that. Thy hope and thy upright living. Okay? So notice, the 1602 bishops had hope where?
At the end.
Nope.
In the middle.
Okay? 1602. Do we have the insertion of the word not?
Yep.
Okay? Is not this thy fear? Okay? Notice, is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy uprightness, and thy ways, and thy hope is moved to where? So does this signify that the King James translators wanted to move thy hope from the middle of the verse to the end of the verse?
Yes.
Yes. Okay?
It's also different that they had thy upright living as opposed to uprightness of thy ways.
Upright living, uprightness of thy ways has changed as well. So we should, I'm telling you, this is why I'm glad we go over this stuff in class. Because I seriously start getting cross-eyed looking at this stuff, okay? I get cross-eyed because it's just like your brain does things where you insert things there that possibly aren't there. So yes, that's an additional change, okay? So the uprightness of thy ways. Because remember, let's just scroll back up quick. Remember in Bod was the entire last clause rewritten. Remember? They crossed out all of that and did they rewrite it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Thanks for catching that. Okay? So now let's go to 16:11. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, the uprightness of thy what? So here's a change from thy uprightness to what?
The
uprightness of thy ways. So is there an additional change here over what was in Bob?
Yep.
Okay? The uprightness of thy ways and thy hope. So this is the thing I want to point out too. There's some debate right now whether Bod was done before or after the translation was published in 1611. To me, it's clearly done before because you still have later changes to the text than what are exhibited in Bod. Does that make sense? If Bod were done after the 1611, then would Bod match the 1611 every time? You follow what I'm saying? Okay? Now let's go to 1629. Is not this thy fear? Is not thy fear. What's taken out by Cambridge 1629?
Mm-hmm.
This. Okay? Thy confidence. Notice now they assert what?
Mm-hmm.
And the uprightness of thy ways, thy hope. So, when they take out this, do the translators want that to be there? Seemingly the answer is what? So then they add the word, then they add a word and, Cambridge 1638. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence? Now watch, have we completely moved the clause thy hope?
Yep.
Thy hope was put at the end in Bod 1602, it was at the end in the 1611, it was at the end of 1629, now it's put back into the middle where it was originally in the 1602 bishops.
Mm-hmm.
You guys following that? Okay? And the uprightness of thy ways. And then this reading established in 1638 by Cambridge, look at the Bible in front of you, Job 4, verse 6, is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways. So the reading that you have in front of you became the standard reading after which edition? 1638 Cambridge. Are there wording differences between the 1638, the 1629, the 1611, and Bod 1602, and the original Bishop 1602? Are any of those differences substantive? Can you rightly call all of these printer errors?
No.
No. You can if you want to majorly beg the question. That is an interpretation of convenience that is not reality. You agree with that, Mike?
Yes.
Why do you agree with that?
Because there's too many variations from one to another, for one thing. And, if you take this verse out of context, it's really a difficult verse. You have to go back to, say, the 325. For the thing which I greatly feared has come upon me. You have to know what is that thing. And you have to understand what is leading up to that sentence, that verse. And Norton admits that it's difficult. He says it gives the Hebrew words just as they come without making sense. But I think you can't make any sense unless you read some verses before
The context, okay? But if we go back to our definitions here, okay? Printer error. An error introduced into typeset copy by the compositor. Are all of those changes across all those editions, are those all printer errors?
No.
No way. That is an interpretation of convenience to fit a narrative. Okay? Now you might argue maybe Norton has his own narrative. I don't really care right now what Norton says. What I care about is to show you are there clearly various levels of revision as you're working your way through these different editions, right? Where later editors are making changes, okay, to the text in at least two different occasions. Now, none of the edits are substantive, but it seems to me it does King James advocacy no good to sit here and say, like Reagan has said and others have said, these are all printer errors. Okay, now I'll stop there and give you guys an opportunity to respond before we go any further. So this, what we're talking about right now is the exact thing that I got criticized for in social media before I taught this lesson. How do you argue with the objective facts? Put aside whatever Norton says. I don't agree with everything Norton says either. But has he accurately cataloged with screenshot evidence of the various editions, has he accurately cataloged the changes that are made to that verse?
You can't change the whole sentence structure and call it a printer.
No.
I'm moving a word from one place to another place in the sentence.
You cannot call that a printer error. If you are misprinting a letter, a character, one word, then maybe. Okay, but we'll see as we get into some more of these if we have time. Alright, does anybody else have anything else before I read the next point?
Like you said, it's not really substantive differences. I look at all those and it's a different way of saying the same thing.
Correct. They're different ways of saying the same thing. Okay? But you gotta understand, Bart, that there are many within King James advocacy that will say it has to be every jot and every tittle. Okay? Exactly in the right order. Well, if that's the standard, and you look at a table like this, do you have a problem? Which is why the position that Dave Reed and I have sought to enunciate on this issue of you don't need verbatim identicality of wording. If you need verbatim identicality of wording, do you have a problem? But if you say that preservation requires verbal equivalence, do you have a problem? No, because they're all of them verbally equivalent. Okay? When one charts the changes made to Job 4:6 in the various editions of the Authorized Version, it is inescapable that all of these changes are not simply the correction of printer errors and updates in spelling. It is undeniable that the Cambridge editors impacted the wording of the text. This example from Job 4:6 underscores the importance of the position enunciated in my co-authored book with Brother Dave Reed, The Myth of Verbatim Identicality, How God Actually Preserved His Word. If one requires verbatim identicality of wording as a standard for preservation, they must choose which edition of the King James Bible is correct in Job 4:6. On the other hand, if one acknowledges the principle of verbal equivalence, the problem is alleviated and all the renderings of the AV charted above are different ways of saying the same thing without using the exact same what?
Words.
So, I don't see how... Here's what happens. We've already talked about this, right? So King James opponents will come and they'll say, well, which edition? Which edition got it perfect? Which edition got it this or that? And you see the definition, the standard of perfection that they're using there is verbatim identicality. Now, they're not saying it that way, but is that the implied assumption? Yeah. So it doesn't do any good to adopt that understanding of this, because then you will have to tell me which one of these renderings of Job 4:6 is the perfect one to the exclusion of all others, when it seems to me there's no reason for you to make that choice. Any questions? So, Professor Norton concludes the paragraph cited above by providing some additional examples. He says, quote, perhaps if the 1629 editors had allowed themselves such license on a regular basis, the latter history of the King James text would have been different. For other exceptions, of which I know only five, involve restoring a deliberately deleted and, even putting it in italics to show that it is not in the Hebrew in Psalm 113:9, and revising the order of subject and verb, reversing the order of subject verb, I said becomes said I, Isaiah 6:8, and similarly in 2 Esdras 2:18 and 1 Maccabees 10:29, while saw I becomes I saw in 2 Esdras 13:12. Beyond these, the editors left matters of style alone. Okay? For the sake of time, we will look only at the additional examples noted above from the canonical text. So we're not going to look at the ones from the Apocrypha. Okay? So let's look at Psalm 113, verse 9. So here's 113, verse 9. Here's the 1602 bishops, the starting point. He maketh the barren woman to keep house and to be a joyful mother of children. Okay? Bod 1602 makes some changes. He maketh the barren woman to keep house, removes what? And to be a joyful mother of children. So did they intentionally cross off the word and here in this verse?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then here's 1611. He maketh the barren woman to keep house. Notice what's omitted in the 1611. And to be a joyful mother of children. And then you have the insertion here of praise ye the Lord. So I believe I noted here that I couldn't... This handwriting here is a little bit unclear to me exactly what it was saying. But then look at 1629 Cambridge. He maketh the barren woman to keep house and, in italics, to be, so this whole clause now is in italics, to be a joyful mother of children, praise ye the Lord. Okay? Now you could say, what difference does it make? And I would say, none, other than the note, are they making changes? Are they clearly making changes to the text? They take the word and out. Then they publish it in 1611 without the word and. Then in 1629, do they put the word back in italics along with the words to be and to be? Now is that in the text and in italics? Okay, so go to your Bible. Now you don't need to do that because I got the table here. They also added praise ye the Lord, okay? So here's 1602 bishops. Bach takes the word and out. 1611 publishes the text, minus the word and. 1629 Cambridge inserts the word and puts this whole clause, and to be, in italics. And then does that become the standard reading? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Was the unwritten or the unclear handwriting in the box, 602, what they interpreted as praise ye the Lord?
I believe so. Yes, I believe so, but unfortunately, I have to be honest. Some of that handwriting is a little hard to make out sometimes. Okay, looks like my writing. I could have been an editor. So we already went through that. So let's look at the point here. Evidence furnished by Bod 1602 reveals the King James translators intended to remove the word "and" from the clause, and to be a joyful mother of children, as found in the 1602 bishops. The 1611, with its removal of "and," confirms this conclusion. Later in 1629, the Cambridge editors reinstated the word "and" italicized the clause "and to be." Was this the correction of a printer error in 1611, or a stylistic choice of a later editor that reversed the initial choice of the translators?
Intentional.
You guys seeing what I'm saying here? Okay? So when they do this, in 1629. Is that the way the translator said they wanted it to be? Reflective of the choice in 1611? Or is this editor making a different choice? It doesn't affect the meaning of the verse, a hill of beans. Okay? But it's still a what? Change. Okay? Any questions? You got a comment, Mike?
It looks like their Cambridge is going back to the 1602 bishop reading, but I think it, on the one hand, some people want to keep the Hebrews the same wording, same words as the Hebrew used, and on the other hand, I think the translators wanted to make it more understandable English, more in keeping with the English of the day, so people could understand.
I would say there are probably instances of both, of them wanting to retain the original word order of the Hebrew as well as wanting to make understandable English. Okay. Did you guys have another observation?
Oh, down further, Isaiah is not spelled right.
In the notes?
In the middle, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. The first listing is not spelled right on Isaiah. Right here, Sylvia?
Isaiah.
So let's look at another example if we have time. Okay, Isaiah 6:8. Okay? Now look, guys. The reason we have to do this is because of the stuff that's been said. The stuff that's been said does not comport with the facts. Okay? Now, you've seen enough of these examples now. Does Norton need to be a saved guy to catalog differences like this?
No.
No. Okay? Isaiah 6:8.
Why would anyone judge somebody's salvation ever?
Because people feel they have the right to do that, I guess. Well, the same guy says, I'm a Baptist pastor, by the way, in his latest article.
But I mean, somebody's unsaved, so automatically he's a liar?
Yeah, I mean, can an unsaved person read and compare two different verses for different wording changes? Seems to me that you can, right? I mean, like, if you have eyes and you can read, you can do something like that, and you can make a list of where you see differences, right? It's not hard to do. You don't have to be a believer in the text to do that. What offends me more is when so-called believers in the text say stuff about the text that's not true. That's the bigger problem. And that does fire me up. And that's the problem they don't want to talk about. Okay? All right. Isaiah 6:8. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord on this matter. Whom shall I send? And who will be our messenger? Then I said, here am I, send me. Okay? Let's look now at Bob. So we can still see both of those. Okay? Also, I heard the voice of the Lord on this matter. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord on this matter. Whom shall I send? Whom shall I send? And who will be our messenger? And who will be our messenger? Then I said, here am I, send me. So are those the same? And is there any changes noted here in Bob? If you look at the picture of Bob, are there any changes? No. Okay. Isaiah 6:8, 1611. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying. Did Bod call for the insertion of saying?
No.
No? Was saying in the 1602?
No.
So is there an insertion of the word into the text post Bod? Yep. Yes. What word is it?
Saying.
Now watch. Whom shall I send? I think that's the same, right? And who will go for us? Make sure I'm reading this right.
Who will be our messenger previously?
Previously it was who will be our messenger. So there's a change post Bob, which we need to make bold as well, Mike. Okay?
What?
We need to bold the change, and who will go for us versus who will be our messenger.
Right.
Then I said, here am I, send me. That's the same, right?
Yep.
Now watch 1629 Cambridge. Let's stop just for a minute. So 1611 inserting the word same.
Yeah.
Did 1611 insert the word same?
Yes.
Yes, and did it change a phrase that was not marked in Bod? So there's an additional word added, and there's a change that is not marked in Bod, right? Let's go to Isaiah, let's go to 1629 Cambridge. Okay? Notice. Also I heard the voice of the Lord. Is that the same? As 1611.
Yes.
Saying, here I think we have a punctuation difference, a semicolon versus a comma, right? Whom shall I send? Whom shall I send? That's the same. And who will go for us? That's the same as the 1611. With a question mark there, that was not in the 1611, but that's punctuation. Most people aren't going to have a problem with that. Now watch. Then said I, here am I, here am I, send me. Now notice what change do they make? They change I said to what?
Said I.
Is there a substantive difference in meaning between said I or I said?
No.
No. What is that?
The reverse word or editorial change.
That is an editorial preference on how it should read. That's what it is. If you track the evidence back, is all of the evidence suggesting that that's what they do? Okay, and I actually need to update this because I neglected to note this change from will be our messenger to who will go for us. Okay? So, now let's talk about this. Let's look at our definition of a printer error again. An error introduced into a typeset copy by the compositor. I am willing to concede that I said versus said I could be a printer error. I'm willing to concede that could be a printer error. You got the same words just in a reverse order, right? And especially if the compositor is putting the page together by having it read to him out loud, we're not sure exactly how this was done. But I can see how this could be a printer error. What I cannot see, even remotely as a printer error, is what we saw up here earlier with Job 4:6, where you take an entire clause from the end of the verse, thy hope, and you move it to the middle of the verse. That's not a printer error. I could be persuaded to view what's going on here in Isaiah 6:8 as a printer error, the difference between said I versus I said, but there's other things going on here, right? And even if it says I said versus said I, you understand that there are people that are willing to say that if it has it inverted, it's not capable of conveying the exact sense. Okay. What's the standard reading? Go to Isaiah 6:8. So guys, I'm sorry that I tax your patience on stuff like this. But you gotta understand. This is the kind of stuff that has to be done because of the kinds of things that are said. Verse 8. Also I heard the voice of the Lord, comma, saying, comma, whom shall I send, comma, and who will go for us, question mark. Then said I, here am I, send me. So what reading became the standard reading? The 1629 Cambridge.
Now it doesn't matter a hill of beans whether it says said I or I said.
Okay? Oh, don't get me started, Eli. You're tempting me. You're baiting me. Okay? So comparison between Bod 1602 and the 1611 illustrates the draft status of Bod 1602. Bob records no changes to the base text of the 1602 bishops at Isaiah 6:8. Yet the 1611 exhibits changes when compared to Bob on this matter, was changed to saying. Meanwhile, so in other words, the changes noted in Bod cannot be post 1611, because not all the changes in the 1611 are noted in Bod, which means that they go through the text again after Bod was produced and decide to make some other changes. Okay. Meanwhile, the 1629 Cambridge said, "I said in the 1611 to said I at the end of the verse." This change became the standard reading. All prior English Bibles, including Wycliffe, Coverdale, Matthew's, Great Bible, Geneva Bible, Bishop's Bible, and the Douay Rheims read, "I said," in Isaiah 6:8. So, the change introduced by the 1629 Cambridge editors, introduced by the 1629 Cambridge editors, the correction of a printer error or a stylistic change? I'm going to say to you that I believe it is a stylistic what? Change. Okay? Alright. So, and Mike, we need to note here that I think there's some other things that I need to fix. So these notes are going to have to be updated online because there's some changes here. So I think if you go to the bottom of page 6, that last bullet point, there's some additional bolding and changing that needs to be done in that table. Okay? Specifically, the change from who will be our messenger to, and who will go for us. Okay? Alright, guys, we got about 6 minutes. If you look at the rest of this, you'll see that there's way more than 6 minutes of material left here. So, I don't think there's any profit right now in trying to forge ahead with this, because there are additional references. So what I want you to see, what I did, is I took Norton, and I annotated Norton with the actual examples of screenshots from these documents so that you could see what he's talking about. Okay? And here's why I did that. It's one thing to read through it and hear him say, "Oh yeah, they did this, they did this, they did this." But is it a very different thing when you can visually look at it yourself from the documents in question? So I have in my possession a 1629 authorized version, the Cambridge University Press, and I have a 1638. So we can look at, I can go into Norton's work, I can check Bod, I can check all these things, and we can see what they did. Okay? A lot of them are printer errors, but not all of them. Alright. We've got a couple minutes for any questions or comments that anybody might have. So,
I have a trivia question.
Is it related to this?
No. This Isaiah 6:8, what movie was that quoted in? A movie quoted that.
I'm sure there's been more than one. Should I know this movie?
It's a war movie.
Well, and fill us in, because it's not...
Okay, it was the movie Fury.
Okay.
With Brad Pitt.
Not sure I saw that one, but okay.
But they were in the tank, and they were all ready to be annihilated. And then he came up and said this. And then Brad Pitt, who was the sergeant in charge of the tank, quoted, "Yes, that's Isaiah 6:8, and they didn't realize that."
Okay.
But that's how that rang a bell with me. I go, "Oh, this was in that movie."
So did they quote it correctly?
I can remember the actor doing that, and he said, then said I, because he exclamated that. He said, said, "Who shall they send? Send I." And I remember him making a point from that.
So to say, we don't talk that way anymore, right? We don't say said, said I, we said I what?
I said.
So that's, you could argue that's a printer error. If you wanted to do it, I wouldn't argue it too strong. Because all you're doing is you're flipping what? You're flipping the two words around and putting them in a different order, right? But you can't convince me that the one in Job 4:6 is a printer error when you look at the level of editorial change that went on in that verse. And if you have to have everything exactly so, which is what jot and tittle preservation requires, then you got a problem. I'm sorry, but you do. And that's not Enlightenment rationalism talking. That's objective facts from the printed history of the text. Okay? All right, any other questions? All right, if there are no questions, next week is the last Sunday in May, right? It's also a holiday weekend. Is everybody going to be here? Does anyone know they're going to be gone for Memorial Day? Then we'll have class. What I'll probably do is take some of this information and reshuffle it and work up some new notes for the next lesson. And we'll probably also then touch briefly on there might be enough here for a whole lesson. I'll have to think about what I want to do about that. The reason the notes are so long is because of all the pictures and the examples and going through them. But to me, if we're going to do this, we gotta actually put our eyes on what's going on.